Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. On May 14, 2022, a group of Pamiris, the people of Tajikistan's eastern Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast, or Gabal, went to the city administration in Horog, the regional capital. The group informed authorities of plans to hold a public meeting 2 days later to call for several local officials to be dismissed and for the release of locals being held in connection with protests that occurred in late 2021. Their advance request to hold a meeting was fully in accordance with Tajikistan's laws. When people started to assemble on May 16th, they were met by police and security forces who fired rubber bullets and tear gas at them. Tajik authorities then started a brutal campaign of repression against the people of Gabal that has seen dozens of Pamiris killed, more than 100 imprisoned, and over the course of the last year, the systematic destruction of the Pamiri culture in Gabal. With the anniversary of the May events approaching, we take a closer look at what happened then, what has happened since then to Gabal and its people. To discuss all this, I am joined by Suzanne Levy-Sanchez, visiting scholar at Harvard's Davis Center, who spent many years in the mountainous areas of Tajikistan and Afghanistan and is the author of the book, Bridging State and Civil Society, Informal Organizations in Tajik-Afghan-Badakhshan. And Bakhtiar Safarov, founder of the Central Asia Consulting Firm in the United States of America, who is originally from the Gabal region of Tajikistan. So thank you both for joining me. And Bakhtiar, I want to start with you. You're watching events in Gabal closely. What is the daily life like for the people living there right now?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce. Thank you for inviting. And I want to greet you and Dr. Susie. Thank you for invitation. And I want to greet your listeners as well. So the daily situation, as we get a lot of, reports, it's not obviously not as used to be. People, my understanding that they were not expecting such turn in the events because, you know, like usual, they came, protested, they get, the steam out and then went back. But the life was ongoing. People like, youth or whoever went protest came back and the life was normal pretty much. Right now, what we see is people are more worried on the day-to-day life, and we see reports starting from, obviously restriction a lot of freedoms. They cannot go to, do any protests. So we see there is not obviously active social media from the ground, and we hear a lot of, property, illegal seizure. So a lot of issues but we see more concerns regarding the, like, for example, deployment of CCTV cameras, that in that's now will be installed, or I think they're already installed in Horo. And stuff like that. It's like new initiatives that coming from governor. Now they have this groups called explanatory work among youth. So this kind of squads, they go village to village and explain people that, you don't do that, don't this. They call them the people squads. So stuff like that. These are new things that's coming. Obviously, they don't have access to speak to different people that they used to be, the NGO. So, yeah, basically, it's a new reality. I can say that.
Okay. Thank you, Bakhtiar. Suzanne, I'm going to get to you that you've had long experience with this region. It has been what was commonly described in many reports as a restive region in eastern Tajikistan. And yet what happened after May 16th last year was seems to have been much more brutal and intense than the usual kind of violence. Can you kind of walk us through what happened starting on May 16th, just before, and then what happened after, to let our audience know how significant this was, and that it was much, as I said, much more intense than previous violence in the region.
Thank you, Bruce, for having me. It's good to virtually see you, Bakhtiar. It's an honor to be here today. So there was a planned protest in accordance with Tajik law on May 16th. I think from what I've read, reports of over 1,000 people. showed up from the community. The government fired on them with rubber bullets, and they used tear gas. And then soon after that, they killed, first on May 22nd, Commander or Colonel Mohamed Bouker, who was a local leader of the people. They then proceeded to kill two other local leaders in June. And right after that, they started arrests, and there were mass arrests in June of that year and late May. Hundreds of people fled the country, and there's reports of anywhere between 40 and 67 people that were killed. There was also a protest soon after the May 16th protest, when Tajik vehicles were coming to Harok to crack down in Roshan, which is a neighboring district, and the Tajik security services fired upon people who were blocking the road. And soon after that, they also killed a local leader, Yodgar, from the area, as well as his associates, and then arrested his family members. From there, they proceeded to arrest leaders from the neighboring Porshnef as well. And I think that there have been, as you say, restive occurrences or issues between the locals and the government, 2008, 2012, 2014, 2018. But you're correct, Bruce, this was markedly different. It was in the past, once the conflict was sort of ended, there were generally negotiations between civil society leaders and the government. And while arrests here and there continued, and usually there were some blacklists, and it wasn't great, but there wasn't mass surveillance and mass crackdowns and arrests. After this one, the government continued to basically attack the leaders in the community at all levels. So they started by killing certain leaders. Then they arrested journalists. They arrested lawyers. They arrested civil society activists. They shut down NGOs. They curtailed religious practices. They started to seize buildings. They seized business leaders' businesses and arrested them. They even arrested the head of the hospital for Gorno-Badakhshan. And so basically they also arrested artists and bloggers who were promoting Pamiri language or even researching it. There was also, I think it's 30 up to 38 now, extraditions of Pamiris from Russia back to Tajikistan. At the moment, there are, from what I've heard, over 2,000 Pamiris, primarily men, in prison, which is 2% of the male population. And if you think of that, that's also 2% of the heads of households, which is a huge number. And then allegedly I have a report of over 150 people and their bios in prison, but from my sources, I've been told it's over 300 that have been arrested since November. And I think about 50 after May. And then what there is a trickle of arrests of about 4 to 5 per month of leaders or even potential leaders for the community. So the social fabric. Lastly, I'll just say that, you know, the reasons for it, I can speculate, but, you know, the West withdrew from Afghanistan and China very much moved in. And China has very different ideas about control of the region versus either Western institutions and NGOs that were supported there that have been largely shut down, or Russian control and support. You know, the Russians often played a dual game. On top of that, Ukraine happened. And so Putin, from what I have gathered from my sources, changed his tune in regard to Rahmon, and Rahmon made some requests in exchange. Again, this is allegedly in exchange for his support of Putin in Ukraine, and that included these extraditions of certain Pamiri leaders, as well as support for cracking down in Gorno-Badakhshan. It is a strategic crossing point for trade from China, and China did provide, I think it's $9 million in infrastructure funding directly after the killing of both Mohamed Bouqir and Horsan Dinzori in June. So it's a combination of local ethnic tensions as well as this international geopolitical space.
Okay, let me ask you one more question. You know, at the time, the Tajik government blamed the violence on, they said there were terrorists, foreign-sponsored terrorists or terrorists that were working under with aid from some foreign party, someone outside Tajikistan. Have you in the last year seen any evidence to support that claim, that there was actually outside interference and the terrorists had gotten loose in Gorno-Badakhshan?
No. You know, that's been an on and off claim in various ways over the past over a decade. And they really trumped up those charges this time. And they, you know, with their anti-terror operation and their big campaign and there's never been any evidence of that. Ismaili Shias are not engaged in either terrorism locally or cross-border terrorism. And there were also trumped up charges of plans to overthrow the government or speak against officials or whatever these charges were. I have all of the articles of the charges. And they did shift to much stronger charges by the government after this crackdown versus the ones in the past. And therefore, the prison terms have been much longer because there are claims of terrorism. But yeah, there's just no evidence of it. Even the recent killing of the two men who crossed the border from Afghanistan or somewhere involved in Yazghulami, which is a different Sunni sect of Pamiris. You know, the evidence on that is pointing more towards something quite different than actual drug traffickers breaching the border from the other side. So anyway. Does that? I hope that answers that question.
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much.
Can I add, please? Yeah. So, and that's a very good point that Susie and Bruce, you're making. That's claiming terrorists and calling people of Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast is just the thing that even some Western institution kind of believed in this and fall into this narrative. But now, you know, people, I guess, you know, and I hope they will realize that the people of Gabal basically wanted the rule of law, but like any other nation, but have been blamed for weapon and drug trafficking for years. You know, if you look at the reports, they say, hey, everybody's like that, you know, and they were just talking about the economic hardship, marginalization within the country, you know, range of it's a language issues, like they couldn't, you know, they can't speak their own language, exclusion of exercise any significant political influence, you know, lack of proper political participations, you know, stuff like that. And most importantly, the governor and all judges and all executive are, you know, appointed by president of Tajikistan. So these are the things that have been people of Gabal have been saying for 30 years, but unfortunately, they got blamed, and some Western organizations also believe in this narrative. Yeah, that's it for me.
Thank you, Bakhtiar. You know, I want to follow up on some of the what's happening in the region right now. With Pamiris, mainly are Shiite Muslims, to make that distinction clear for the audience. How easy is it for the Pamiris to actually practice their religion? I mean, you said that it was more difficult, but can you tell us a little bit more about that? You know, what can they go to mosque? Can people study the religion? I mean, what's the situation?
So, I honestly don't know much except for the reports that I am reading that what's happening that in Khorog and around that district that practicing Ismailism, most of the Jamaat Khonas, they call them the prayer mosque, like, you know, religious facilities are closed now, so they cannot go and practice their religion and praise there. So the only two active Jamaat Khonas, the religious organizations, are one in Dushanbe and one is in Khorog, so it's certainly not enough. And that was another organization called ITREP. It's also related to teaching you know, Ismailism, that institution also activities were restricted. And as you know, about the Khalifa Dawlat Mir, who was also jailed just because of he conducted religious ceremonies for people who, you know, died during this conflict.
Thank you. Suzanne, I think you want to add something about Davlat Mirov, do you not?
Well, Khalifa Mozaffar Davlat Mirov was arrested on July, I think it's 26th or 25th, and sentenced to 5 years in prison for engaging in, I think he was arrested for engaging in extremist activity or overthrow the government or something like this. But it was basically, from what I understand, because he performed ablution for Colonel Mahmoud Bokhirov, who was killed on May 22nd. You know, he was one of the only independent Khalifas in Harok and had been for a long time. I met him after he became Khalifa for the area as well as before. When he became the Khalifa in 2012 after Imam Nazar, from what I think was killed around that time. I think that it is interesting that the only, and when I say independent Khalifa in Tajikistan at this point, all imams and Khalifas are, their pensions are paid by the state and they are required to wear state outfits, and they no longer have the freedom of religious expression, in a sense. And so Khalifa Mozaffar did express some independence of the Ismaili religion, and he's now in prison. And I want to add that the practice of religion, the Ismaili Shia practice Friday prayers in the home within the community. And they did have a number of mosques throughout Harok that have been closed, like Bakhtiar said. They're no longer allowed to have pray in the house. I think the women were just told they can't go to the Jamaat Khana in Harok anymore. The Tajik security services are stationed in the mosque itself. They did seize religious books, and Itreb had a wonderful library that I visited many times that the government seized and shut down. They also have shut down a number of religious schools, summer camps for children, and they've also stopped any volunteerism within the Jamaat for raising money for the community or funerals or weddings or anything else. And the biggest impact on that is that a number of people have had to sell their properties and move to Dushanbe because their heads of households are in prison. And from my sources, the prison situation is that the people in prison are not being fed and there isn't proper medical care. So the families have to support these heads of households that are in prison. And the only way to do that was to sell their properties and move to Dushanbe, which has also been a fairly extreme impact on the people there.
Okay, thank you. And we have reached the halfway point in our discussion, so it's time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis Podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinner, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. We're talking about the Tajik government's continuing campaign of repression against the people of Eastern Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast and the government's efforts to destroy the Pamiri culture. And joining me for this discussion are Bakhtiar Safarov, founder of the Central Asia consulting firm in the United States, who is originally from Gabal region of Tajikistan, and Suzanne Levy-Sanchez, visiting scholar at Harvard's Davis Center, and who spent many years in the mountainous areas of Tajikistan and Afghanistan, and is the author of the book Bridging State and Civil Society, Informal Organizations in Tajik-Afghan Badakhshan. Suzanne, I want to come back to you. The Aga Khan Development Network was very active in Gorno-Badakhshan. In fact, they were really kind of the only ones doing anything to make any improvements and help the people out there. What's happened to that network since last May?
From what I understand is many of the majority of projects and programs have been stalled or stopped by the government. The government has seized numerous properties of AKDN that they say were not officially transferred in the official manner to them. They are investigating the land agreement of the Serena Hotel in Kharok, which is owned within the Acadian institutions, as well as the Aga Khan Health Services Hospital. The Aga Khan Health Services Hospital was built within UCA because the government of Tajikistan would not grant a lease in another area of Kharok. So the Acadian built it within UCA, but because it wasn't properly leased through the government, they are now trying to turn that hospital into a military hospital. And I do want to say, I'm sorry, this is a little bit off topic, but you know, in September, I started a company called Hoof Global LLC with Asladeen Sherzamanov after we helped rescue him from where he was. And we have assisted 82 Pamiris from fleeing the country in various wells, as well as freeing Russia. So the ongoing persecution and fleeing of the people from the region, including those people working for AKDN, is a major issue. The other major issue is the majority of good jobs in the region are with AKDN and the Aga Khan Foundation. And since a lot of that has been either shut down or stopped, and those jobs are beginning to disappear, which is going to cause a major issue for the people there because there isn't something to replace them. And the businesses and whatnot that were seized by the Tajik government are not employing primarily Pamiris. They're bringing in Tajiks from outside the region, Tajik non-Pamiris, and which is also creating a problem.
Thanks. Bakhtiar, I'd like you to speak a little bit about that too, because I've also heard these stories that there a lot of the Pamiris are leaving Badakhshan, whether it's because they can't make a living or they fear government repression. What are you hearing?
Yes. Well, I heard that like 250 Pamiris now seeking asylum in Camp Nuremberg. It was like this report was like maybe 2-3 months ago, and they had some issue, difficulty with the Pamiri language, and Tajik language on translation. That news came in. I'm aware about this. Also, I know I don't have an exact number, but I know a lot of people also came here to United States. I hear a lot of news that it's been a very hard transition for them as well. So, but the good thing is that now it was like a disaster, basically. People still in shock and people are recovering. So we see that a lot of people are, starting to showing back the activism, during the recent protests in Berlin, where they were organized by National Alliance of Tajikistan for Abdullah Shamsuddin, the son of Islamic Revival Party, member. And some people say 30 Pamiri activists in Germany already participated in protests. Some people say hundreds. So the number is fluctuating. We don't have an exact number. But yeah, so they're just leaving. And now people say that you don't see any, basically, youth in the streets of Gobao anymore. And I spoke to one of my sources, and they said that they don't even issue passports for people who are in the 11th grade, which is kind of senior year. They don't issue them passports anymore. But for I believe it's a fear of maybe them leaving, or just they just want to keep them in the country.
Okay, so they're not allowed to speak their language. They're not allowed to practice their religion, or they can with severe restrictions. The government isn't putting any money into the region, and so people are left to their own devices. There have been claims that this amounts to cultural genocide. Suzanne, what do you think? Is that a fair characterization of the situation now?
I do think it's cultural genocide. I think it's very difficult to prove those things given the definition of them. But if you do break it down by all levels of society, language, religion, culture, and even recently, the UN Special Rapporteur for religious belief, I forget the full name of that, but they visited the region and you know, they said that there's this persecution going on. And then the Tajik government came back and said, we don't recognize Pamiris as an ethnic group. But then if you look on the bots controlled on social media by the Tajik security services, they regularly do speak about Pamiris in often negative ways in terms of them being involved in, you know, hooliganism or terrorism or whatever it happens to be. So there's definitely a disconnect between the government's behavior toward the Pamiris and assertions about them, and then the government's denial of their identity. So when you think about cultural genocide, it really is a squashing of people's identity, not allowing them to have their own assertion of who they are, their practices and beliefs, their freedom of expression, their freedom of assembly, their freedom of linguistic choices, etc., education around their religion and their language. So it is going on at all levels, and it does need to be, I think, publicly stated, and the international community needs to recognize it.
Bakhtiar, you're from there. Does this look like cultural genocide to you?
Yeah, exactly. And I agree with what you wrote as well, you know, calling it as a cultural genocide, 100, you know, and what happened is the local community leaders have been able to kind of tackle it for the last 30 years. But, you know, the whole resources and everything is right now, like I'm talking on the ground, is depleted. So that's, I agree that now they're going to escalate on this. And there is a fear of population even abandoning their homes. You know, that happened in Vanj district earlier, you know, that you go to the villages, you know, that's, you know, like, for example, in one village across, you know, my grandparents' home, it's like 40 families already left in Vanj district. But because it happened towards Vanji people, the whole, you know, suppression happened earlier. So the people start leaving in like, you know, 10 years, 15 years. But now I see that similar situation is going to happen in areas that's the people from Pamiris, you know, in Shugnan, in Rushan, Nishkashim. I expect that a lot of people will be leaving to different countries. So that happens. And speaking about genocide, as you know, the Genocide Watch already put it on stage 5. Stage 5 organization, let me read that, stage 7 preparation, stage 8 prosecution. They put it stage 5, but I have to clarify. But Genocide Watch is also, you know, kind of monitoring the situation as well. So, yeah, I agree with it's not cultural genocide, but actual, you know, like physical. I think they have a plan basically to have certain people either jailed or killed. So to me, that's how it looks like.
Can I add one thing,
please,
Bruce? I want to say, you know, Hoof Global's work, and I'm not just trying to plug the organization. I want to be clear. You know, it's been really challenging to assist Pamiris fleeing both Russia. We've also rescued out of Ukraine, and we are housing a bunch of people. But the point I'm trying to make on that is that we get calls just about every day, or contacts rather, messages begging for help or assistance of people who are fleeing persecution, who have been visited repeatedly by the security services. So I think what Bakhtiar says right there is I think there have been these purges in other parts of Tajikistan, agreed, but I don't think it's been quite the wholesale, every layer of society purging, as well as the sort of bizarre derogatory statements by security services toward the Pamiris as well as publicly.
Okay, thank you. We are running short on time, although I'm quite sure we're going to return to this topic. You know, both of you are watching the situation there. You know as much, if not more, than pretty much anybody else. Bakhtiar, what would you tell people who are trying to get information about this region? You know, what don't they know that they should know?
Well, so what they don't know is the Central Asia restricted so many, you know, information and free media that basically they even us who are from the region don't have enough information. So what they would do is to press the government to actually open up the media organizations to make sure that they have access to report. And as you can see, the Marius Fossum, he proposed a targeted Magnitsky style sanction. So they should, the public in the West and other European countries should tell to their governments to step up the efforts. Because as we can see, the government-to-government relations are going strong. You see a lot of Western countries, United States, Europe, supporting government as usual. The business is going as usual. But for civil society organization, it's not. So that's what happening. The government becoming stronger and civil society at the same time is pretty much, in jail. So they should know that, and they have to help political organizations and organizations that will be established with help. That it could be financial, it could be, political, because we expect that Gbao will also have to have some structural legal representation. So we need help with consultant. We need help with financial to make sure that kind of structure is established. And we need to do that because we have a lot of political prisoners. So political prisoners, that's only Shohion, the chairman of the Supreme Court, said they convicted 109 people during his conference last month. So we don't know exactly how many people right now being jailed. So we need help from organizations, government and non-government, to start addressing those issues, because we can't have all our people being jailed for nothing. You literally witnessing the years of 1937 that we had when we were part of the Soviet Union, that people can, for nothing, that people can come and take you and put you in jail just because they don't like you, just because they think they can do that. So we have to educate people. And I want to thank you, Bruce, for doing a lot. So on educating people on even with Majlis podcast, I think this is the seventh or eighth that you're hosting, and I see a lot of other experts are joining the organization. I have hundreds of here dozens that I already here put up. It's Human Rights Watch, International Partnership for Human Rights. Human Rights Watch, that's a Helsinki Foundation, Norwegian Helsinki, Front Right Defenders, Freedom Now, Foreign Policy Center. The Mary Lelor, so she did an amazing job on putting a lot of recommendation. Unfortunately, I don't see anybody who will start implementing those recommendations. So we have to have some kind of, body or legal entity who will start implementing those recommendations, because she's been there in December. Nothing basically changed. So we want to make sure that the people know that those recommendations exist. People, experts write a lot, but unfortunately nothing is helping. And our brothers and sisters, even Ulfat Honi Mamachora, she's the only lady that's being now jailed, and nobody can help. And we just stuck here. A stalemate, I would say, at this point.
Thank you, Bakhtiar. Suzanne, last word goes to you.
Thanks, Bruce. Bakhtiar, thanks so much for the thorough overview of what needs to happen. I agree on every single point. I want to say that in December, the EU and its member states announced the Enhanced Partnership and Cooperation Agreement with Tajikistan. And one of the things they stipulated is that negotiations depended on, quote, tangible improvements in Tajikistan's human rights situation, including with regard to the freedom of expression, media, and assembly. So my hope is that the international community, including EU and its member states, US, and other countries that partner with Tajikistan, that believe in freedom of expression, assembly, right to association, and religious freedom, will tie their monetary support and their cooperation with the country to these basic human rights principles that Tajikistan has actually signed on to with the UN. And I do think there have been so many organizations that have written reports at this point about it. There was a good article in The Diplomat recently, and Minority Rights Group has done excellent work. The Rooftop Report, if people want to know more about the situation, is an excellent resource. So I think what people need to know is that the surveillance state that is now installed in Gorno-Badakhshan is similar to that of what is going on with the Uyghurs, was largely funded and provided by the Chinese government. And when people get information out from Khorok or Gorno-Badakhshan at this point, it shows a sense of desperation that people should understand, because if they get information out, they are literally risking their lives to do so. And so that's how important it is to them. There's also refugee communities, over 300 in Germany, and as Bakhtiar said, they need support. And what people don't know is the rules for asylum seeking in these countries are very strict, and the people need financial resources in order to gain legal support and support for translation of documents. There's also a large refugee community at this point in the U.S., as Bakhtiar said. There's a large community in Canada. And there's also a number of people in Moldova and Georgia that are seeking asylum. So there is need for assistance for those people, as well as the international community giving a voice for the Pamiris in fighting for their rights, since they're risking their lives to do so.
Okay. Thank you very much. As I mentioned, we could talk about this for much longer, and I'm sure that we will be coming back to this topic again in the very near future. But I do want to thank you both for being on the program. Thank you, Suzanne, and thank you, Bakhtiar. As always, a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.